Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the Wall Street Journal, from the Associated Press, and more. This broadcast is available as a podcast, as with other Religion in the News broadcasts, by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the September 15th edition of the Washington Post. This article is entitled, "Prominent Southern Baptists Are Dropping Southern Name Amid Racial Unrest." This article is by Sarah Pulliam Bailey of the Washington Post. Leaders in the Southern Baptist Convention are increasingly dropping the southern part of their Baptist name, calling it a potentially painful reminder of the convention's historic role in support of slavery. The 50,000 Baptist churches in the convention are autonomous and can still choose to refer to themselves as Southern Baptist or SBC. But in his first interview on the topic, convention president J.D. Greer said momentum has been building to adopt the name Great Commission Baptists, both because of the racial reckoning underway in the United States and because many have long seen the Southern Baptist name as too regional for a global group of believers. Our Lord Jesus was not a white Southerner, but a brown-skinned Middle Eastern refugee, said Greer, who this summer used the phrase Black Lives Matter in a presidential address and announced that he would retire a historic gavel named for an enslaver. Every week we gather to worship a Savior who died for the whole world, not one part of it. What we call ourselves should make that clear. The shift takes place at the end of a summer of racial unrest, when Confederate monuments have been removed, schools have been renamed, and the Washington football team has dropped its moniker and is looking for a new one. For Southern Baptists, the change also reflects a long-standing desire to remove confusion when the convention launches churches in the northern United States and overseas. The convention formed in 1845, splitting from Northern Baptists over Southern support for missionaries who owned enslaved people. Despite a historic drop in membership last year, it is considered the largest Protestant denomination in the United States, with 14.5 million members. The convention will continue to legally operate as the SBC, officials said, citing the hefty cost and complexity of a legal name change. But since August, its website has declared, "We are Great Commission Baptists," an alternative moniker that refers to the verses in the New Testament when Jesus commands his disciples to baptize believers in all nations. Ronnie Floyd, who heads the convention's executive committee and was on President Trump's Evangelical Advisory Committee during the 2016 campaign, addressed fellow Baptists in a recent letter as Great Commission Baptists. Greer says hundreds of church leaders in several southern states have committed to using the alternate name. And Greer announced Monday that his church will use it as well, and that the theme of next year's annual gathering for the denomination will be, "We are Great Commission Baptists." Danny Aiken, president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in North Carolina, and Albert Moeller, Jr., president of Louisville's Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, said they both support using Great Commission Baptist as a description, though they won't legally change the names of their schools. About 80% of churches in the convention are located in southern states, according to the 2019 SBC annual profile. But Greer said that moving forward, Baptists' shared evangelistic mission, not southern culture, should help shape their identity. He said 20% of churches in the convention are led by pastors of color, and 63% of the churches that were planted or launched last year were led by people of color. While theology hasn't changed, he said, what does need to change is the culture of the convention. We as Baptists want to be defined by 2025, not by 1845. Southern Baptists debated changing their name for decades, but church leaders concluded that legally doing so would be too expensive for their huge network of churches, seminaries, colleges, and other institutions. A recommendation allowing Southern Baptist institutions to call themselves Great Commission Baptists was narrowly approved by the convention in 2012, but most leaders chose not to do so. Marshall Osberry, president of the convention's National African American Fellowship, said all 13 pastors on his board were in favor of adopting Great Commission Baptists. You'll have skeptics with people who say you're only doing it because you're trying to whitewash history, said Ansberry, pastor of Antioch Baptist Church in Fairfax Station, Virginia, and first vice president of the convention. But it's a good time to do it. There's a sincerity. Marshall Blaylock, the white pastor of South Carolina's First Baptist Charleston, which is believed to be one of the earliest Baptist churches in the South, said he decided to adopt the name Great Commission Baptist after he met with black pastors in Mobile, Alabama in July in an effort to build bridges. I would say I'm Southern Baptist, and they'd look at me like I think I could like you, but I'm not sure, Blaylock said. He said he didn't realize before that meeting just how many black Christians outside Baptist circles associate the name with the support of slavery and racial segregation. Blaylock and others are wary of being perceived as part of a broader politically liberal movement or taking actions that could be seen as aligned with the Black Lives Matter movement or the Democratic Party. Still, Blaylock said he thinks using a different name is the best way for the convention to move forward from its past. Anybody who knows why we're trying to do this knows we're not trying to be woke, and we're not trying to cover up the past, Blaylock said. We need to remove barriers. Blaylock was on the 2012 convention committee that proposed adding Great Commission Baptist as a DBA, short for Doing Business As, which allows organizations to legally do business using a particular name without having to create a new identity. The committee's report focused on geography and did not discuss whether the Southern Baptist name draws a connection to the convention's historic support for slavery and segregation. At its inaugural meeting in Augusta, Georgia, in 1845, the convention considered naming itself the Southern and Southwestern Baptist Convention, according to Nathan Finn, a Southern Baptist historian who is provost of North Greenville University in South Carolina. Southern Baptists disagreed with Northern believers over several issues, but the final straw was whether missionaries could be enslavers. The Northern Baptists, now formerly called the American Baptist Churches USA, started calling themselves the American Baptist Convention in 1950, which caused resentment and provoked competition among Southern Baptists, Finn said. That denomination is now viewed as more liberal in its theology and culture. Finn said he was ambivalent about using a different name for years until this summer when he jumped on board. I'm not embarrassed to be a Southerner, he said. It's about what that word conjures up for people, especially people of color. They're saying that name is a hang-up. When my people hear that name, they think slavery. God forbid we keep a name that evokes that. In 1995, the convention issued a formal apology for its complicity in slavery and racism. Gary Frost, a black pastor who was director of missions for the Steel Valley Baptist Association in Ohio, stood on the stage of the convention and accepted the apology. Frost said he has no problem identifying as a Southern Baptist now, but he also thinks the convention is changing. More people of color have positions of leadership than 25 years ago. We're not holding on to symbols of the past. That's painful for some people. That's part of their heritage, he said. When you learn that it's hurtful and hurt the spread of the gospel, you have to be willing to let go of them. John Onwuchekwa, an Atlanta-based pastor, left the convention this summer, disgusted by the heavy support for Trump among Southern Baptists. He said changing the name forces the convention to talk about why it identified as Southern in the first place. It was never about geography, he said. The convention was one bad marketing meeting away from being the Confederate Baptist Convention. But Jamar Tisby, author of The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism, said using a different name could be seen as duplicitous or misleading. I don't know that the denomination as a whole has done a good job of teaching its sordid history, he said. Changing the name now might make that even harder. Jerry Vines, a retired pastor and past president of the convention, said he is an old-school guy and wants to be explicit about his Baptist identity. I do like truth in advertising, said Vines, who led the First Baptist Church of Jacksonville, Florida. I like up front to let people know who you are. Not once you get someone in, you slip it to them. Some Baptists say they couldn't care less about the name, including Robert Jeffress, pastor of the historic First Baptist Church in Dallas. Many churches have already dropped the name Baptist entirely, including megachurches like Rick Warren's Saddleback Church in California and David Platt's McLean Bible Church in Virginia. I think we live in a post-denominational age, Jeffress said. Churches are less and less concerned about being defined by a group they can't control. Our next article on religion in the news comes from the September 15th edition of the Wall Street Journal, and it's entitled, Amid Coronavirus, Jewish High Holidays Take a Different Shape. The subheadline, Celebrations of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, usually a time of gathering, find new and creative forms. These services are about renewal. This is by Claire Ansberry of the Wall Street Journal. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers, who leads the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, recently organized a drive-up distribution of special prayer books so his congregation can follow along at home while he live-streams services for the Jewish High Holidays from his living room, which has become his makeshift studio. He sounded the shofar, a ram's horn, as they arrived and handed out small jars of honey to symbolize hope for the new year, Rosh Hashanah, and a special booklet honoring the 11 people killed in a shooting at the synagogue 2 years ago. Rabbi Myers will remember them in his streamed service on Yom Kippur. Next week marks the beginning of the latest season to be recreated against the backdrop of the pandemic. The Jewish High Holidays, starting with Rosh Hashanah at sundown on Friday and ending with Yom Kippur 10 days later, will be followed by other Christian and secular holidays, all of which will look much different as people figure out how to celebrate under new restrictions. In the Jewish faith, this time of year is marked by large gatherings, both to pray and celebrate. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is followed by 10 days of intense reflection, ending with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. During this time, even many who rarely attend services crowd synagogues and come together in homes to share dishes based on recipes passed down through generations. COVID-19 has changed these traditions everywhere. In Israel, a second nationwide lockdown announced this week in response to a wave of infections is expected to last through the holidays. Some synagogues that normally don't permit electronic devices on the holidays are figuring out ways to stream some services, for instance, starting them before sundown when a holiday begins. Others are planning to hold in-person services in tents and set up in their parking lots, requiring reservations and shortening them to 20 minutes. People can't gather in their traditional centers of worship, so they're finding new ways to pray, says Elizabeth Drescher, a religious studies professor at Santa Clara University and author of Choosing Our Religion, The Spiritual Lives of America's Nuns. The ground has been pulled out from under their feet, Dr. Drescher says. It doesn't mean that people are not being spiritual, but they are doing it differently. Lists of ideas are circulating on how to celebrate at home this year. Among them, an online tutorial on how to blow the shofar, the ram's horn symbolizing a spiritual wake-up call, on the Shabbat organization's website, shabbat.org. The Reformed Jewish Congregation provides an online tool for spiritual inventory with questions such as, what brings you joy, and what in your life feels holy right now, and suggests posting a collage of those who would normally attend synagogue together with the hashtag #IAmSittingWith. Asylum Arts, a network of Jewish artists, asked members to create projects, including e-cards, musical compositions, and interactive rituals, to celebrate the high holidays in new ways this year. Rabbis at Temple Emmanuel in Newton, Massachusetts, organized dozens of small conversations, maximum 12 people, in members' backyards for reflection and discussion on how to become a better person in the coming year. One rabbi led socially distanced nature walks for silent reflection during Elul, the month-long reckoning before the holidays. In the past, as many as 200 people would come to Tashlik, a Rosh Hashanah service in which people would gather at a lake and symbolically cast aside their sins, throwing bread into the water. This year, they are scheduling several smaller groups of about 40. We have to reinvent how we do things, says Temple Emmanuel's Rabbi Wesley Gardenswartz, who has been live-streaming services since March. He says more people are praying online than previously attended in person. Before the pandemic, he would get 20 people in a typical evening service. Since the pandemic hit, about 200 participate virtually. I'm very optimistic about our high holiday services this year, he says. Most of us are worn out by the pandemic, and these services are about renewal. With limited capacity, pre-registration for in-person services is required. Some synagogues have already reached capacity and are compiling waiting lists. After the pandemic hit, Cherie Pear, an illustrator, a mother of three, and an Orthodox Jew, started creating two children's activity books focused on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as part of the project sponsored by Asylum Arts. Kids help a raisin find its way to the center of the challah bread, make cards for family and friends, and cut out Jonah and the whale story figures. It's a brief escape from everything, says Ms. Pear, who lives in Los Angeles. Her synagogue doesn't live stream services, but is holding smaller services, with people spaced 6 feet apart. Her husband, Eli Schiff, will attend for the holidays, but Ms. Pear, who is from New York and lost an uncle and close friends to COVID-19, hasn't returned to the synagogue. She will stay home, asking a neighbor to help with the kids so she can pray without distraction, but says she will miss attending services. Being in the synagogue is an important time to reflect. Otherwise, it's mommy, 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 says Ms. Pear, who also won't be making her usual spreadsheet to keep track of plans for the holiday gatherings. Allison Carabin, who grew up in a conservative congregation in Pittsburgh, attended synagogue regularly and went to Hebrew school as a child. Over the years, she attended synagogue less frequently, but had a tradition of going to the Kol Nidre service on the eve of Yom Kippur with her dad, her sister-in-law, and her late grandmother. She hosted a meal at the end of Yom Kippur, where she served her aunt's special kugel, a baked noodle pudding with golden raisins, cream cheese, and topped with a mixture of frosted flakes and melted butter. This year she won't be joining, saying it seems less compelling over Zoom. I feel a little sad. It's the first time I can remember that I won't be going to a service, says Ms. Carabin, who works at the nonprofit Jewish Residential Services. She hopes to resume her place alongside her relatives at Yom Kippur services next year. There is something very powerful about being in the same room with other people, saying the same prayers, and reflecting on the year in silence, she says. I think I will want that again in my life. We turn next on Religion in the News to an article published on September 16th by the Associated Press. This article is entitled, What's in a Name? At the Vatican, a Debate on Inclusiveness. And this article is by Nicole Winfield of the Associated Press, Dateline Rome. The Vatican responded Wednesday to criticism that the title of Pope Francis's upcoming encyclical on the post-COVID world is sexist, saying the document, Fratelli Tutti, Brothers All, in no way excludes women. In Italian, fratelli means brothers, but is also used as the inclusive brothers and sisters. Since Francis takes pains to always address crowds as fratelli e sorelle, brothers and sisters, the absence of an explicit reference to sisters in the title was seen by some as another expression of exclusion in an institution long criticized for treating women as second-class citizens. On Wednesday, the Vatican's editorial director, Andrea Tornielli, stressed that the title was taken from the words of St. Francis of Assisi, the Pope's namesake, and therefore couldn't be translated differently. Writing in the Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano, he said an encyclical by its very nature is addressed to the whole world, and that the title in no way excludes half of the human race. On the contrary, Francis chose the words of the Saint of Assisi to initiate a reflection on something he cares about very deeply, namely fraternity and social friendship, Tornielli wrote. He therefore addresses all his sisters and brothers, all men and women who populate the earth, everyone inclusively and in no way exclusively. The Vatican is expected to release the encyclical on October 4th, the Feast of St. Francis, a day after the Pope travels to the Umbrian hilltop town of Assisi to pray at the tomb of the saint and sign the document. It is expected to articulate much of his preaching on the need for human solidarity and fraternity to both care for the planet and the population in the aftermath of the coronavirus pandemic and the social inequalities it has exacerbated. Vatican encyclicals are the most authoritative form of papal teaching, and they traditionally take their titles from the first two words of the document. In this, this case, Fratelli Tutti is a quote from the Admonitions, the compendium of guidelines penned by St. Francis in the 12th century. Writing last week in Religion News Service, the Reverend Thomas Rees, a church commentator, said the title was unfortunate and said he hoped the Vatican would at least translate it in English as Brothers and Sisters All. It is sad to see the church continue to suffer from self-inflicted wounds, Rees wrote. The concern about language in the title will increase the focus on the language of the entire encyclical. Rees, an American Jesuit, dismissed the argument that fratelli in Italian was inclusive, even though many Romance languages use the male plural in such comprehensive ways. Couldn't the church get ahead of the curve for once, he asked. Tina Beatty, a British theologian and Catholic women's rights campaigner, also dismissed the explanation as disingenuous. Sorry, when they say gender ideology is destroying society, and given the Vatican's gender politics, I'm not willing to become a brother when it suits them to call me one, she tweeted Wednesday. I'll engage with what I know will be a brilliant vision, but I'll name this misnomer every time I do. Tornielli, the Vatican editorial chief, said the themes of the encyclical, fraternity and social friendship, are precisely the themes that unite men and women. For this reason, all readers should be able to understand the title Fratelli Tutti with the absolutely inclusive connotation that is intended, he said. We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from the Deseret News entitled Gen Z's Looking for Religion. You'd be surprised where they find it. And the subheadline, the latest research from Pew points in that direction, with 8 out of 10 teenagers reporting that they believe in God or universal spirit, and 77% saying they feel a strong sense of gratitude more than once a month. And this is from the September 13th edition of the Deseret News by Maya Jaradat. Dateline, Salt Lake City. With religious services taking place online, this might seem like a moment for digital natives like Gen Z to step into the stream of faith. But new data suggests that the opposite is happening. Pew Research Center reports that those under 30 are the least likely to tune in to virtual worship. Similarly, new data show prior to the pandemic, 13 to 17-year-olds attended in-person religious services at rates similar to their parents, but they were much less likely to pray. Researchers, however, argue that surveys of religious belief often ask the wrong questions to gauge the faith of youth and young adults. They say that Gen Z, a group that was born from 1997 and later, is eager for spiritual engagement, but the form it takes might confound conventional ideas of worship. Young people aren't becoming more or less religious, says Elizabeth Drescher, a professor of religion at Santa Clara University and the author of Choosing Our Religion, The Spiritual Lives of America's Nuns. They're becoming differently religious. Some also say that Gen Z's lack of affiliation and low rates of online engagement can be understood not as a crisis, but as an opportunity for religious leaders to rethink the way they're doing church, not just for youth, but for everyone. A newly released study by the Pew Research Center found that prior to the pandemic, America's teenagers attended religious services at rates that were nearly identical to their parents, with 44% of teens saying that they go to services at least once a month, and 43% of their parents reporting the same. While church attendance is similar among adults and their teenage children, their feelings about organized religion differ. Some 43% of parents said religion is very important in their lives. Only 24% of teenagers said so. When they were asked about daily prayer, 27% of teenagers reported doing so, in comparison to 48% of parents. So while teenagers might be going along with their parents to church, their low rates of prayer and the relatively few who rank religion as very important suggest they might not be accepting formal worship. Because of that, researchers cautioned against drawing conclusions that Gen Z will reverse the national march toward secularization. They also pointed out that a drop in religious observance is typical when children leave the nest, and so the age group surveyed, 13 to 17, may change their practices when they leave home. Generation Z's low engagement with virtual religious services dovetails with the data. Pew Research Associate Claire Geskowitz says that when people were polling about religious practices was conducted in July, older adults were more likely than their younger counterparts to say they had watched religious services online or on TV in the last month. Of those 65 and up, Geskowitz says, 43% reported watching online services in the last month. For the 50 to 64 crowd, 38% had viewed virtual services, while fewer than a third of adults 30 to 49 had attended online services, and less than a quarter of those under 30 tuned in. But those who work closely with teens and young adults say Gen Zers are just as spiritually inclined as older generations. The latest research from Pew points in that direction, with 8 out of 10 teenagers reporting that they believe in God or universal spirit, and 77% saying that they feel a strong sense of gratitude more than once a month. When considering Gen Z's religiosity, people have to change their understanding of what constitutes a spiritual practice, says Drescher, including avenues of expression that are often missed by the affiliation-based measures common to polls. Most of the surveys, Drescher explains, asks things like, do you believe in God or a higher power, or do you attend worship services? Though a majority of her students identify as non-religious, Drescher says, they still look for social structures to express community cohesion and shared values and stories that create shared meaning. Many of Drescher's students have found that in a spiritually rich Black Lives Matter movement and other social justice causes. Those who attended Black Lives Matter protests and marches this summer, she says, reported experiencing the social justice work as being part of something that is transcending, that is bigger than oneself, Drescher says. They also felt like they were gathering with others who held common commitments and perspectives, and that doing so constituted a meaningful way to make change, which all sounds a lot like a religious experience. We're seeing the same kinds of things, Drescher observes. The physical body, the social body, is engaged in the world in a way that hasn't been happening as much in brick-and-mortar churches in recent years. Drescher says that youth participation in the Black Lives Matter movement comes from a well of moral and ethical hunger. Social media, she argues, also feeds and amplifies that hunger. It starts with social media making visual the moral abuses of the culture, something young people experience as an incarnational pull, Drescher says. People are drawn to be with other people by what they are seeing and learning and feeling on social media. But if BLM fizzles out, where will Gen Z take that hunger for community and shared values and spiritual sustenance? Drescher doesn't think that the quest for social, racial, and economic justice will end anytime soon. The moral abuses of our culture, made visible on social media, will continue to pull young people into the streets, she says. The manner in which youth engage, or don't, in this virtual moment points to larger issues that churches should be wrestling with right now, according to Dr. Heidi Campbell, a professor of media and religion at Texas A&M University, and the author of Digital Religion, Understanding Religious Practice in New Media Worlds. As religious institutions rushed to get online when the pandemic began, many religious leaders assumed if we do a broadcast version of our service, all will be well, Campbell said. People felt disconnected as a result, Campbell says. Just because you use social media doesn't mean you increase social interaction in the space. Religious leaders have to build a community integrating the technology, she continues. Just having events online or offline doesn't mean you have a community. And that seems to indicate to be what's missing in bringing Gen Z into the fold, community, participation, connectedness. Some religious leaders have created a religion that has been very event-based and experience-based and not very community-based, Campbell observes. This moment, however, presents an opportunity to rethink everything. Religious institutions, Campbell says, should be trying new ways of gathering and trying new ways of meeting, including small groups to talk about services online or on the phone. In that model, the focus isn't on a pastor or on an event. Rather, the sermon becomes a conversation point for a community to build upon. Similarly, Pastor Zach Lambert of Restore Austin, a non-denominational church, reports that since the pandemic began, youth engagement was highest when a Black staff member hosted a Zoom discussion about racial bias. We had a ton of young folks on that call, Lambert says. That was really their main church participation since COVID hit. Lambert, who is a millennial himself and was just 26 in 2016 when he, his wife, and another couple they met in seminary founded Restore Austin, adds that he believes participation is the key to attracting Gen Z to any sort of spiritual activities. We've seen a hunger in Gen Z for more experiential stuff, something they get to participate in rather than receive. They want to belong to a community rather than an audience, Lambert remarks. Lambert reports that Restore Austin has seen slow but steady growth over the past 4 years. One of the things that he is most proud of is that 80% of the members of his church are people who had abandoned church and had disconnected from organized religion before they found Restore Austin. Though Lambert observes that young people aren't attending online services in large numbers, as Pew's findings suggest, his experience points to Campbell's remark that community and small groups are the key to participation. We've got pretty vibrant small groups on Zoom right now, he says. The participation of young folks is way, way higher than it is on Sunday mornings. That's the end of our time for Religion in the News this week. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired.